Imagine the entire population of Malaysia. Now imagine that all of its 30 million residents are suddenly displaced overnight. In March last year, India's Prime Minister announced a nationwide lockdown to stop the spread of COVID-19. The economy came to a grinding halt. Migrant workers who depended on daily wages had nowhere to go. Some walked back hundreds of kilometers back to their villages. Some died of hunger. Some were assaulted by the police. Others died simply of exhaustion. For context, I return to my earlier example. One estimate says that the number of migrants displaced in India could be around about the same as the entire population of Malaysia. That's about 30 million people. Joining us on this podcast is noted human rights activist and author Harsh Mandar. He has just come out with his new book on this exodus called Locking Down the Poor. He says that this is one of the worst humanitarian crises that the country has faced since the partition of India by the British back in 1947. Let's ask him just how big this crisis is. Harsh, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Uday. India is passing through one of its worst humanitarian crises in my entire lifetime, and probably since India's partition. And the important thing to understand is that this crisis was not created by the virus. It was created by public policy choices that were made to deal with the virus in a country. Which is very different from industrialized countries abroad. If 9 out of 10 workers are informal workers who have no social security whatsoever, if you have the majority of populations in cities of people who are either homeless or live in small shanties with 10 people crowded into a single room, 100 people sometimes sharing a community toilet with no running water. The very idea of a lockdown, which the Prime Minister said, please stay at home, work from home, keep social distance, and wash your hands regularly. He was, in fact, only speaking to the middle class. Even in conception, there was nothing in the design of a lockdown for the large mass of the poor. In fact, they were cramped into. We had just 500 cases when recorded cases at the time the lockdown was imposed, with just about 3.5 hours' notice. Trains came to a grinding halt. The whole economy was shut down. We've never seen this is the largest economic lockdown in human history anywhere in the world, where for a billion and a quarter people, you suddenly completely shut down all demand, and you completely shut down all supply. And you have among the smallest relief packages in the world for people affected. It was wrong in so many multiple ways because, as I said, even in its design, it excluded the most disadvantaged. So it was really, if at all, it was providing protection to the middle classes and people with homes and who applauded. And we seem to just forget about the working poor and the destitute poor. I worked with the homeless for the last 20 years. And while I was listening to our Prime Minister, I was just thinking what, even from tomorrow, what will happen to them? Because they literally search for work every morning. And on days they don't get work, they go to a gurudwara, they go to a dargah or a temple. All of these would shut down. What would happen to them? And the impact of this in the costs that we're paying for this decision in terms of the economy, we're seeing a massively contracting economy for the first time again since independence. I don't think we even understand what that means. There are dangers of stagflation, which is even more dangerous. Micro small enterprises form the bulk of our manufacturing. It's unlikely that they will be able to rebuild. Jobs are just not going to be there. And And finally, if there was any justification whatsoever for the lockdown, it was for building our public health systems to prepare. India is a country which has chosen to have a highly privatized healthcare system. We spend less than 1% of GDP on public health. More than 2% of GDP is spent out of pocket for the private sector. And that's 80% of trained health personnel work for the for-profit private sector.
Right.
And you also have a situation where the long extended lockdown was actually very little new infrastructure was created. The Prime Minister talked about 100,000 new beds. He was being economical with the truth, because what they were not doing was creating new beds, but they were repurposing existing beds. So we had cancer patients in Bombay being pulled out and actually made to sleep on mats under an overbridge to create COVID beds. That is the story, and I can go on. It's been devastating in its human consequences. Urban India has never seen this kind of explosion of hunger and joblessness. I was on the streets from almost the second or third day, because
Right.
I said, whatever happens, we
I
go to
was,
the
yeah, you know,
homeless.
that was going to be my next question to you. In fact, I'm glad that you brought that up. I also find your parallel with the partition very interesting, because you even cite those numbers in your book. The number of displaced migrants displaced by Mr. Modi's lockdown is nearly three times the number of people displaced by the partition of India in 1947. Now, you just mentioned that you and other volunteers traveled across India meeting migrant workers. And you were certainly helping people in need, but you were also doing something else. You were also documenting what was happening. You were recording and seeing because these are the rough notes of history that we're writing right now. When you were out there on the streets of some of our cities, some of our biggest cities, including our nation's capital, what did you see?
I saw, devastating, humiliation and desperation of the very poor for no fault of theirs in multiple ways. So we have what are called labor dust. These are places where people, informal workers, gather every morning searching for work, and anyone can come pick them up. And some of these labor hutas actually are where homeless people gather, who are even more vulnerable. So the first place we went to was, on the second or third day, was to one of the labor hutas in Old Delhi. And we found that the numbers normally were about 1,000. They were already about 4,000 or 5,000 people. They were waiting for hours. There were other places on the banks of the Yamuna. There were about 4,000 single homeless men lived there normally. That had swollen already to about 10,000 people. Just the rumor that somebody was distributing food and people would fall over each other, scramble. The question of social distance didn't even exist. I don't like the term social distance, because India has actually been practicing social distance through caste for the last 2,000 years. We needed social solidarity and physical distancing, but that was impossible for the poor. And we hadn't really planned to launch a massive relief sort of program around the country, but we almost were drawn into it because of the desperation that we saw and the failure of governments to respond. People started sending us money from around the world. We finally distributed 10 million meals across the country. That was still a tiny drop of what was actually needed. But we didn't see it as a charity. We saw it as solidarity. People you care about are in a desperate situation. And how can you do it with dignity and with respect? Very soon our numbers started circulating, and they became de facto distress call sort of centers. And very quickly it moved to industrial workers, sites of parts of the city which where industrial workers live. And they would tell us that we've never in our lives thought we would put our hands out for food to anybody. They were badly exploited. None of them I found were getting minimum wages, statutory minimum wages, etc. They didn't have social protection, but they still had, fixed their lives. Their children were going to school. They were paying their rents. They had regular lives, and suddenly, all of that broke down. And they were, we started going there within minutes. A line of 0.5 kilometer, 1 kilometer, sometimes 2 kilometers would form. We didn't even have the capacity to reach. You cannot treat and finally the government of Delhi was shamed into distributing cooked food. But for that, again, the way it was done, literally people would have to wake up in the morning and sit in a line in the hot sun, maybe 3 hours, 4 hours, to get a plop of rice gruel. And you just eat it, and then again you'd have to sit in line for another 3 hours for the next meal. It was economists Prabhat Patnaik, Jyoti Ghosh, and I wrote a series of pieces, opinion pieces, where we were saying that it's so elementary. The middle class is getting their salary sitting at home. You have to provide the statutory minimum wage to every person, and provide the equivalent of your, a universal ration system. And it was, at the very, very minimum, if you had to have a lockdown, that is what we calculated it would cost more than 3% of GDP. The irony is that if they had done that, the huge economic contraction that would have happened now, the displacement of the largest displacement in distress displacement in human history, except for the movement of slaves from Africa, happened. And all of this distress would have, people were, it was 40 degrees sometimes. People were in this closed truck containers, cement mixers with no air, and they were paying more money than I would pay for a flight. To travel in that way, that was the desperation. How could we put people through? I mean, that's why I've used very strong language. I mean, this is my editor keeps telling me that this is a book that people will read 50 years from now to understand what happened at this time. And I've called it a genocidal set of public policies. I mean, and that's strong language. I called it crimes against humanity. You cannot treat millions of people in this way, with a hubris and with a total lack of compassion.
Right.
The contrast with China on the one hand. China, at its peak, locked down 5% of its population. We locked down 100%. And on the other hand, Pakistan, and that is probably, the most humiliating for us. Pakistan's not a well-governed country by any standards. And Imran Khan is, we all dismiss him as this playboy elite guy. But he said something when he was asked to follow India's example and lock down the country. He used a language which I will always remember. He said, if we were a rich industrialized country where everyone had work and homes and social security, we could have considered it. But what will happen to my poor people, he said, what will happen to my poor people if they don't have work? They won't be able to eat. And I just cannot allow that to happen. And Pakistan didn't do very much. I mean, it didn't have a lockdown, and virtually it was not locked down. It didn't do a great deal more. But today we find it's control of the virus. Its figures are much better than India. And its economy is doing much better than India. So I think the
In fact,
important thing is that.
even certain nations which have very high population density, Vietnam, for example, stands out as an example of a country that managed to do the whole lockdown situation properly. So I want to talk about the media coverage of this crisis, the corporate media in India. And I've been trying to look for a polite, kind word to describe it, but let's just go with government friendly. They're seen as very government friendly. So the coverage almost looked like they were covering an act of God, like, painting these migrant workers in the same way you would talk about victims of an earthquake or a tsunami. But you are very clear in your book that this is, and you write this too, the central thesis is that this was not an act of God. This was not because of the virus. This was policy failure. To what extent do you think the Prime Minister is personally responsible for this humanitarian crisis?
I think the Prime Minister is personally, centrally responsible for this. Part of it is the way he takes decisions. He's de facto converted our system into a presidential form of government, very authoritarian. And you know, the evidence is that he did not consult Parliament, he did not consult the chief ministers, he did not consult his cabinet. And now we have documents to show that epidemiologists, even within government, had advised strongly against. He didn't consult them. Who took this decision, and on what basis is you know is known? And it's primarily hubris of an extreme kind that you can get away with this. The media, as you're saying, is mostly celebratory of the government, whatever it does, and critical. And but the distress of the migrants was so dramatic that for a brief period we did have reporting about their situation. But what is going on even now, and with the poor, what joblessness does, the humiliation. See, what people, the migrants are really people who come in from the poor rural parts of Bihar, UP, Madhya Pradesh, Rajasthan, Chhattisgarh. These are all remittance economies. Their families depend on their earnings, and they come here and they work in the hardest of conditions. Suddenly, all of that remittance was cut off overnight. And they had to actually depend on the people who depended on them to provide them some money to survive through this period and to travel. And when they went back, I mean, I spoke to so many migrants. We also organized about 60 buses. And they would be weeping, and they would say that there's no question of ever coming back. One of the labor economists, Ravi Srivastava, said something very significant. He said, it was not just the labor laws which required workers to be registered, some social protection to be given, all of that was violated. He said something more fundamental was violated, and that was trust. That however exploited our workers were, they felt that when a real crisis, government and our employers protect us. And what we demonstrated was that when a real calamity hits you, we won't care, we'll throw you to the wolves. And that is, that is the tragedy. And the tragedy is now that they are returning. And they're returning even with this mirage of trust completely broken. And I've spoken, when we speak to migrant workers who are returning, they say that we would have loved to stay with our families, at this time. But I cannot see my children starving. There's no work whatsoever. Now, when we are being called back by builders, by construction companies, etc., we know that we're going to be, asked to work 14-hour days, 16-hour days. We will, even that illusion of some kind of labor protection is going to go, and the trust that we will be taken care of. And through all of this, at the worst burst of this mass hunger that I've seen in cities for the first time. I've been a district head, and there were times in rural India where I saw mass hunger, when there were recurring doubts. But the city is a place which has many problems, but you will never be out of work. If you even a street child collects plastic bottles and sorts out waste, will earns 100 to 100 rupees a day. You can do that almost from the second day that you're here. If you're willing to work in oppressed conditions, John Robinson somewhere said that if there's anything worse than being exploited, it is not being exploited. And that's the difference between the countryside and the city. And so this kind of mass hunger has been thrown at people. Job opportunities are not going to, it's not suddenly going to repair a lot of those micro, small, medium enterprises. Are destroyed. I don't know how long they'll take to rebuild. And And the Prime Minister thinks it's fit at the peak of this hunger crisis to have himself photographed in changing his clothes every few minutes, feeding peacocks in his garden. You know, there's an enormous degree of uncaringness, and I think that's what I keep trying to argue in the book. It's not so much about Mr. Modi or the government. It's about we who choose them, we who applaud them. I was, you know, so I had, you know, we hadn't planned for this massive relief or solidarity work. Also about reporting, but after a while, I just couldn't bear the fact that people were not hearing these stories. And so a lot of the young people who started coming out with me would say, you know, would give me a lot of hope. I mean, I would ask, are you not frightened about the virus? And they said, one of the boys said that I am frightened about the virus, but much greater than my fear is their hunger. And that is why I have to be on the streets with you and with them. And this one boy with a camera, Sandeep, decided that he would accompany me wherever we go. And after we would distribute food, I often turned reporter and I would, you know, I would record, and we did a series of reports on the ground, describing what people were going through. I mean, I can just go on. People, you know, there's one person, he was on a line, one of our lines, and he was still had not reached the point he was getting his food. He suddenly burst into anger and he said, Modi ji says we should stay within our homes. What does he expect us to eat? Does he want us to break the walls and start eating the walls? And by the time he reached where he got his little bit of rice gruel, he was shaking and weeping. We had women. I remember this woman who, when I was walking past her in the shanty, she was cooking on two bricks on a stove, and she covered it up with her sari. And I stopped, and you know, I said, "What is the problem?" And she said, "I'm so ashamed." And I said, "Why are you ashamed?" She took off the sari, and it was the feet of chickens that she was cooking, which is normally thrown away. And she said, "I've come to such a point where this is all that I can manage to give and to feed my children." And I sat with her and I said, "Please, you should not feel ashamed. It's the government which should feel ashamed that it has brought you to this point. You should feel pride that through all of this, you're still trying to provide for your children as best." Another woman said, "I want to speak before the camera." And when she came, she said, 2 days ago, somebody said food has been distributed at a place. And we all went running and we formed a long line. But when my turn came, the food was over and they gave me two bananas. And then she started weeping. She said, "My stove hasn't been lit for days." So you know, we had no, have no business to reduce our populations to this kind of, you know, humiliating destitution and hunger and joblessness and hopelessness, with no purpose served. And a generation, and you know, one of my favorite books is John Steinbeck's Great War, where he describes the Great Depression, and he also describes, you know, one of the central themes of the book is how the greatest kindness that you can expect is from very poor people to very poor people. And I saw a lot of that kindness in the streets and that kind of solidarity. And I think that it has just begun. We are hurtling into a humanitarian crisis of a scale and a complexity.
Harsh, you know, in my next question, I'm going to push back a little bit and play devil's advocate. Now, in your book, you've quoted a survey from the Stranded Workers Action Network, or SWAN. A staggering 96% of those who were surveyed said they did not receive any government rations. That is a statistic that just, it baffles me to think about that number. 96% said we got nothing from the government, not even food. So it seemed like there was a point where the government did respond to the crisis. You know, we had the finance minister announce a relief package. There were special trains that were run for the workers who were stranded. In fact, a special fund was set up called the PM CARES Fund for those of our audiences who don't live in India or don't follow the news in India. The Prime Minister set up a special fund and asked people to donate. But if workers got no help, then what was all that for? Why was all that announced?
See, it was always a lot of it was optics because the Prime Minister announced huge amounts in its 10% of GDP, 20% of GDP. But when we actually looked at the details, the actual transfers were less than 1% of GDP. So that's one part. I also took up the case with the Supreme Court. I filed a petition saying these food transfers and cash transfers need to happen. The government there claimed that everybody in the country was being provided food. And the Chief Justice of India said something that I find so shameful. He first accepted just the government's general claim that everybody is being provided food, which was completely untrue. And we showed that the data, actually, most of the data that they presented was from two states, Kerala and then Delhi. And the rest of the country was more than 50% of the data of food distribution was just from these two states. But nonetheless, the Chief Justice accepted, and then he made a statement. He said, if people are getting food from the government, then why do they need cash transfers? And I the Chief Justice has pulled me up for contempt, and I would, I would say this again publicly. I wanted to tell him that in that case, Mr. Chief Justice, I will take responsibility for sending you a box of very good food, cooked morning, evening, and night. You should not take a salary. No, the poor are not some other species. I mean, they have, I mean, they need, they have, they're just like you and me, battling very difficult circumstances. Why do we don't have portability of rights? We have a large segment of people who have no documentation, and migrant workers come into the city in very hostile conditions. They don't have a right to get rations. They don't have cards. They don't have documents. The Delhi government, became nativist in extreme kinds of ways. At some point, they said, we won't admit you if you're not a resident of Delhi. You don't have documents to prove that you're a resident of Delhi. When we started, the homeless, the virus reached them late. And finally, I got COVID because we kept telling the government, please start testing among the homeless, and they wouldn't, and we started our own clinic, and we found very high levels of positivity among homeless people. The government had a policy. They said that we won't allow you to test, so you have to bring people to us. When we took them to them, they said we will only test those people who have an identity card which shows that they're Delhi residents. And I said, how absurd can that be? Somebody can even come from Mars with COVID. You'll have to test and treat that person because that person will be spreading the virus to other people here. How can you follow such a policy? I took it up with the government. Fortunately, that one order they withdrew. But they said, we have a policy only of home quarantine. I said, what about people who don't have homes? What about the large mass of people in Delhi who live in one-room shanties? Where will they quarantine? They still don't have a policy for them. It is. What I've argued in the book is that what we've revealed ourselves is that we live in a country where some lives matter and need to be protected. And the large mass of the Indian people, their lives don't matter.
Right, and that actually is a segue to my last question for you. There will be a setup. I have to acknowledge a few of the journalists that you've also acknowledged in your book. You've acknowledged journalists, the work of many journalists like Dipankar Ghosh of the Indian Express, who went out there and got
Wonderful report.
heart-wrenching stories. And I think you also quoted a line from a piece by journalist Ipsita Chakrabarty, which really distills your central idea. She said, the government chose to protect the chosen. Now, before I build up to my last question, I also want to quote a migrant worker who featured in your book. His name is Sudhir Kumar Rajak from Jharkhand, who spoke to the Indian Express. He said, why not step out and die of corona? At least we will be counted somewhere. Now, I want you to reflect on these two lines. The government chose to protect the chosen, and why not step out and die of corona? At least we will be counted somewhere. I want you to reflect on these two lines and tell me what it means to be Indian in Narendra Modi's India.
I think Arundhati Roy, who I also quoted in a conversation with us, the writer, she said, "Corona is a virus, but it is also an X-ray. It's an X-ray of society, which reveals who we are, what kind of people we are." And I think what it has revealed is precisely this: that the Indian middle class and the rich and the super rich, and the governments that we choose are among the most uncaring people in the world. We applaud policies through this period because we felt we were being protected, and we didn't care what happened to the large mass of the poor. The absence of Mahatma Gandhi, actually, a few months before he died, had left a talisman. He called it a talisman. He said, "When in times of confusion, when you know, don't know whether what you're choosing to do is right or wrong, I'll give you a talisman." That talisman is, think of the most weakest, most vulnerable person that you know, and think whether what you are choosing to do is going to make life better for her. And I think that if we had used that talisman, none of these decisions would have been taken because we would have thought of what would have happened to that most vulnerable person. And there are things, I mean, you mentioned Vietnam, you mentioned, I mean, we've gone in for a very different package of very limited lockdowns, but large testing, open testing for all. I've been a district magistrate. In a city like, we have schemes, all the schools were closed, the colleges were closed, universities were there. You could have created places for people to quarantine. You need not have lockdown. You could have had massive testing. I would have nationalized India's private healthcare as Spain did and some other countries did. I mean, if 80% of our health personnel are working for profit, we cannot find the health. It's not just running stadium and putting beds there. You have to have people who are qualified to run them. When I finally got COVID, I decided that I would admit myself. I struggled a lot into a public hospital, but I said I won't go into a private room. I'll go to a general ward, and it almost killed me. It was so terrible. It was almost like hell, and I found that the large mass of people there were not even trained, because regular health personnel were not willing to go into a COVID ward, and so. A boy was telling me that he'd lost his job in a hotel and he was desperate. His family was hungry, so they said, "If you're willing to work, you in." They had a training, didn't know what to do with us. And this was India's premier public hospital. The machines were not, the monitors were not working. The families were not allowed. People were wailing away, thinking that they were going to die. So you were hearing people wailing through the day and night. Nobody reached out to them. My monitor wasn't working, so nobody knew whether my oxygen was going up or down. And with the kind of social capital I have, this was, people would tell me, among the homeless and the poor about their experiences, and they were similar. But they would say that if somebody died, for instance, the corpse would be lying next to you. And you would say, "Please do something about the corpse." And they said, "If you're so bothered about it, you pick it up." And it was largely patients who would then pick up the corpses and take them to the mortuaries. We, human life, and when our Union Home Minister, when chief ministers, when the state health minister, all of them became sick, almost all of them checked in into private hospitals. In terms of public morality, how can you do that? I mean, if you don't have faith in the public system, they would have been treated as got the best services possible. You still didn't have faith in them.
Correct.
What right do you have to exercise authority and power at this point of time? So I think that we basically have revealed ourselves as people of relative privilege who just don't care about the lives and the dignity of people of poverty. And
so,
when we finally, you know, the migrants were walking, the prime minister appealed to charity, public charity. You know, I appeal to employers to pay wages. I appeal to landlords not to charge them rents. That is not how governments function. That's not how, you know, I'm, as a poor person, I'm not wanting to depend on charity. I have certain rights and dignity as an equal citizen of this country. And the government has to take care of those rights. And countries around the world have shown that it is possible to do so.
Right. You know, it almost sounds like you're saying that we've always known that there were two Indias, but COVID-19 really revealed and confirmed
the X-ray.
The X-ray, as Arundhati Roy puts it, of society. 40 minutes are not enough to, you know, delve into every detail of just how bad and just how deep this crisis in India has gotten and is continuing in some way because the labor market is still struggling. But Harshmandar, nonetheless, thank you so much for you know, distilling so many of your thoughts that you've noted down in your book, Locking Down the Poor. It's going to be out soon. Thank you so much, Harshmandar, for joining us.
Thank you, Uday.